I'm Liz Gaines, Senior Editor for All Things Digital, and tonight Inform is hosting the Shared Economy Doing Business with the Joneses. I'm joined by Lisa Gansky, the author of The Mesh, Why the Future of Business is Sharing, Shelby Clark, the founder and CCO of Relay Rides, Leah Buskey, the founder and CEO of TaskRabbit, Corey Smith, the CEO of Hub Bay Area and SoCap, and Nate Blacharczyk, the CTO and co-founder of Airbnb. So tonight, these forerunners of the shared economy will dish on their visions for the future of collaborative consumption and how we can all contribute and benefit. I'm going to start with Lisa, since she literally wrote the book on the shared economy before many of the businesses in the space had even been created. How did you see this coming, and where do you see it now?
Both great questions. Thanks very much, Liz. It's really nice to be here. I saw it coming in part because I've been an entrepreneur for a long time, and in 1999, we raised $60 million to start what was the first photography business, OPhoto, first photo sharing and printing service. And so $60 million bought us all sorts of things, but essentially we had to build an office, build a whole infrastructure, and do all these things that businesses do today in a totally different way. And what I was realizing from watching some of my colleagues start businesses several years ago is that we go about that very differently today. So I did the math and realized that if I was starting OPhoto today, I could start OPhoto for between $2 and $2.5 million, where in 1999 we had 60. And that caused me to start thinking about how much waste there was in the old system, and where we're moving to in terms of the kinds of tools and the ways that we actually work as communities. And as I delved into it more deeply, being an environmentalist, I was really also very intrigued with things like car sharing and bike sharing and this whole idea that we're now moving to a world. My theory at the time was we're moving to a world where in the last century, most people aspired to own things, to own cars, to own homes, to own a business. We're moving to a world in which access to goods, services, and talent will triumph over the ownership of them. And that that's brought to us largely by many things, but social networks, mobile phones, so a lot of technology-fueled, but also socially-fueled, for example, things like the recession. And so when we look at Relay Rides, and we have here Relay Rides and Airbnb and The Hub in particular, those are really wonderful businesses. I don't want to steal their thunder, but they're really wonderful examples for how you can have much more of a rich and deep experience at a very different cost. And so I got very intrigued with it. I built out a database because I'm not a writer and ended up creating this book. It became actually much bigger, much faster than I had, had imagined, or certainly I hoped that it would sort of turn out this way. But what I see happening really is that we're looking at many of the services in our communities, in our homes, and in our businesses in very different ways. And the recession has largely also fueled us to rethink the relationship between cost and value. So if I have a vacation home that I don't use very much, or I have a factory or a commercial kitchen that's just sitting there, one of the main theorems of the mesh or the share economy is that things that we value, like talent in the case of TaskRabbit, things that we value that go unused are actually in that moment are wasted. And that increasingly we can use the technology to, at a very granular level, find interesting talent or opportunities of cars and homes and commercial space so that we can find what's near us and available and gain access to it. And so this is a moment in which it's more convenient and less costly to actually share or to gain access than to own. And there's all these other really wonderful attributes that come with it. Being an avid sharer myself, I've been playing with a lot of these services. So,
and I think you're an investor in some of them, too, right?
I confess, yes, I am also an investor.
So let's hear from some of the entrepreneurs about the examples of shared economy, collaborative consumption, the mesh that they've each created. And tell us a little bit about how you got into what you're doing. So briefly, let's hear from each of you, starting with Shelby.
Sure. Well, so I got involved in startups in 2006 with a company called Kiva.org, which is peer-to-peer microfinance lending. So connects people in the developed world, like many of us, with a few extra dollars with somebody in the developing world who needs a loan to start an income-generating activity. Kiva has exploded. And when I got involved in 2006, it had done $200,000 in loans. It's now done about $250 million. And I learned a couple really important things from Kiva. The first was the power of connecting people online for an offline impact. In 2006, I was on Facebook for a couple years. I was used to social connections, but they sort of stayed online. And for the first time, we were harnessing those connections to actually impact the offline world in positive ways. And the second thing was, Kiva is a social business, and microfinance is usually for profit, but it's really driving social change. And so I saw the power of business to actually drive social change, as opposed to what I was used to was philanthropies and charities. And so I was excited by those two concepts. Then I went to grad school. I was living in Boston, and I was living car-free at the time, which was a new thing for me. But I was really excited by this change. So I found that I still had all the mobility that I needed through using car sharing. I could take a convertible to the beach or an SUV to the mountains, a hybrid to Trader Joe's. I found that I was saving a lot of money by paying for a car only when I needed it. And that I was driving less. I was walking more and biking more and taking public transit more because I didn't have a car just sitting outside. And so all these things felt like very positive changes in my life that I really loved. I also had troubles with car sharing. So I had trouble getting a car close to me on short notice. So there's this one terrible Boston winter day. If you live in the East Coast, I'm sure you've had these days before. It was snowing. It was like, the sleet and snow are coming from sort of all directions. And I was on my bike. I drove the closest car to me, which was 2.5 miles away. So I was sort of trudging through the sleet and the snow to get to this car, and passing hundreds of cars that were sitting on the side of the road, clearly hadn't been driven in weeks. And something sort of clicked in my mind, and I connected those Kiva moments where the power of connecting people online for an offline impact, and realized that the solution to my problem was not more cars. It was better utilizing the cars that we already had and finding a way to make it safe and convenient to connect within our own communities. So that's what Relay Rides, that's where Relay Rides is born. So we're a peer-to-peer car sharing marketplace that makes it safe and convenient to rent cars from your neighbors. Relay Rides provides insurance in an online marketplace to handle the transaction. Carners make good money, on average $250 a month, but every month you see carners making over $1,000. And for renters, it means convenient, affordable access to cool cars right in your neighborhood.
So, Nate, I'm going to ask you to squish your intro just a little bit because there's so much conversation I want to get to.
Sure. So Airbnb's origin is quite organic. It started out with us trying to solve a very specific problem. I have two partners, and they were having trouble paying the rent. They had an extra room. They decided to rent it out specifically for a design conference. And what started out as a website for renting out extra rooms quickly became a website for renting out extra homes. And then it became a website for renting out all kinds of spaces, islands, treehouses, castles, all these things that we had never imagined before. Right. Fast forward to today, something you said, and I want to stress, is that it's very much a multidimensional experience. So one aspect that's quite clear is the economic argument for the sharing economy and for what we provide. But another aspect of it is the experience. And it's truly an experience that wasn't really available before. It can be quite rich. And that's a part of the product that people don't really understand until they use the product, but I think it's responsible for a lot of the uptake, the rapid uptake that we've seen.
Hi, yes, and the Hub Bay Area is a shared workspace for social entrepreneurs and others that are working to have a positive impact on the world in some way. And so it's an example of a shared workspace where I think the trend is growing. The recent studies show that there's about 1,800 co-working spaces now worldwide, split between the United States, Europe, and around the world primarily. And I think what a lot of people want to initially come to a shared workspace is because of value. But that way you don't have to get your office, get your chairs, desk, Wi-Fi, et cetera. You can just get up and start working and collaborating right away. So that's really great. But But the secondary thing that people will quickly find, especially in the Hub Bay Area and other hubs around the world, and there's a network of hubs around the world, is that it's about community and collaboration and the ability to get your idea off the ground in a quick way with the people that are right there in the space. And because everyone that joins the Hub Bay Area, we ask that they be involved in something that's positive for people on the planet in some way. We all operate under a certain framework. We're more or less on the same team. We're all helping each other in lots of ways. So we've got lots of examples of not only the hub being a shared workspace, but also companies that are incubated and started there that are also sharing economy companies.
Thanks, Corey. Leah.
Yeah, so as the founder of TaskRabbit, I started as a software engineer, actually, at IBM. I was a programmer there for about 7 years. And my husband and I, we were sitting at home one night. We were getting ready to go out to dinner. And it was a cold winter night in Boston, just like Shelby's story. I tell you, all these ideas come out of cold winter nights in Boston. But it was February. Yeah, exactly.
But they both moved to San Francisco.
The innovation is happening in the winter in Boston. And so it was February of 2008. Cold, snowy outside. We're getting ready to go out to dinner. We'd called a cab to come pick us up, and we realized we were out of dog food. And we had this 100-pound yellow lab named Kobe that was very well fed every single night. And that night, our conversation turned into, wouldn't it be nice if there was just a place online we could go, say we needed dog food, name the price we're willing to pay, we're certain that there was someone in our own neighborhood that'd be willing to help us out. Maybe even someone at the store at that very second. It was just a matter of connecting with them. And at the time, I was a software engineer at IBM, and I was really interested in social technologies and location-based platforms and mobile technologies. And so I saw the intersection of those three things creating a new platform that I saw as service networking instead of social networking. And so 4 months later, I quit my job at IBM to get the first version of the site launched in Boston. And it kind of snowballed from there.
So sharing is caring and wonderful and makes us feel warm and fuzzy. But how much of an economic impact are you guys having already? Are people making a living or a profit from your marketplaces, your services? Let me start with Leah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big things that I get really passionate about is this idea of micro-entrepreneurship. And we're not just creating a platform for people to share their free time, their special skills, and their services, but we're really redefining what work means to these people. And it's not, you know, the normal 9-to-5 anymore. And they can say how much they want to get paid, which jobs they want to complete, what special skills and services they can offer. We have some TaskRabbits that are cashing out up to $5,000 a month, that are doing 2 to 3 tasks a day, that are doing this as their full-time job. We have stories of folks that had been laid off a couple years ago. We're doing TaskRabbit to sort of make ends meet in between, but have decided to stay in the community full-time rather than go back to full-time work.
What about Airbnb?
Yeah, well, people's homes are the greatest asset that they own, and you see people renting out their space, wide range of prices, but very typically between $100 to $200 a night. I think our average host is making $6,000 a year. Now, that's real money for an individual because, again, these are regular people, oftentimes renting their primary space. That kind of income makes a pretty big difference.
So for us at Relay Rides, the average car makes about $250 a month. So that's pretty close to the average car payment. So, you know, whenever you talk with car owners, you know, the financial reason is usually what gets their attention. And usually when you talk to them, they're just looking to offset their expenses. And so $250 can come close to offsetting the majority of your automobile-related expenses. At the same time, we're seeing people who are more entrepreneurs, who are buying cars specifically for renting out, starting a small business. And it can be real money. So we had one guy named Curtis Chong. He's got a 2006 Honda Civic in Boston, back in Boston, and the entrepreneur's in Boston. His car's worth $4,800, and in his first 9 months on Relay Rides, he made $5,300. So he had a car he was able to use, he was helping his neighbors to get around. He got a free car, and it continues to print cash for him. So It's pretty exciting to be providing these opportunities to people, particularly in a tough economic time.
Yeah. I find it interesting, though, that it seems like some of your companies exist right on the line or maybe over the line of existing laws about labor or real estate or car insurance. And I wonder, it seems like you guys set out with an idea of what you wanted the world to be, but maybe the laws haven't caught up to it yet, if they will. And I wonder, maybe, question for Lisa, do you think that that's a serious risk for these guys? Do you think that might take them out?
We can run out faster than the law. Now, I think that what's happening, what we've seen with the internet, for example, in the early days, for example, with Amazon and a lot of e-commerce companies, there was the sales tax question of whether you, how you pay sales tax, if it's now, you know, all this complicated stuff. And I think that we are very early. I want to just say that all the people here and listening who have ever tried a car sharing or bike sharing or TaskRabbit-like, Airbnb-like service, you know, it's very early. And so we are experimenting. I think what I'm seeing with a lot of cities is there's real concern that's being raised, for example, by if you own an apartment, you know, own a condo in New York City and it's a rent-controlled building and you're working hard to make your payment, essentially, but your neighbor now owns two or three condos and they've got Airbnb traffic flow in and out and they're making, you know, fairly significant sums of money, that tends to annoy people. And so there's been some pushback with respect to services like Airbnb, not only picking on Airbnb. We also have seen in the news other services that do things that look like taxi service or compete with taxis in cities, and that taxis, especially in places like in New York, have a medallion that they buy into. Again, I think what we're seeing is the clash of sort of the old, very structured model, and a lot of these new services, like one that's called Sidecar in San Francisco that's being tested, that's really peer-to-peer, another peer-to-peer ride-sharing service. So, you know, these things, do they compete with taxis? What laws do they fall into? And what I've seen increasingly, and Leah made a comment earlier about the nature of work is changing, I think that we're really at a place right now where the nature of many things is changing. How we get our food, how we work, how we move from spot to spot. And what we're seeing is, like, with cities, and I'll just share this, I've been meeting with mayors and different people in the mayor's offices in about 10 or 11 cities in the last year. And of five of those that I can recall, I, at some point in the interview, asked them, you know, so how are you doing? How's the city doing? And they say, well, really good. I said, great. How do you know? I said, well, okay, we used to know because the commercial buildings were either lots of vacancies or no vacancies. But we realized that that doesn't really necessarily tell us anything. And then we used to know because we knew who was paying taxes and who was employed and unemployed. But now you can't tell because between things like Airbnb and Relay Rides and TaskRabbit, people are making, and all sorts of other ways that people are making money, there's a lot of these micro-entrepreneurial things that are taking place that either support existing salaries or, in fact, allow a family to have a lot of different little jobs. And so I think we're at a...
The mayor of what city said that? That sounds pretty good.
The mayor of what?
Of what city?
Oh, I don't know if I... Well, one that we're close to.
Mm.
But I think that one of the things that, like in Copenhagen, for example, they claim to be very meshy. There's a lot of cities, New York, Paris, London, here, where we're looking at, and in fact in San Francisco there's an active working group trying to define rules and regulations, new laws that are allowing for the entrepreneurial aspect of the sharing economy to be supported instead of squashed. And I think that that's just the real challenge, is there's this tension between those that have power and money with those of us that are trying, you know, new ideas and new models.
Okay.
So good.
All right.
All right, one of
you. You first, Shelby.
Okay, so I'll jump in here as well. I think for Relay Rides and peer-to-peer car sharing, insurance has been the contentious point. And I guess I just want to clarify one thing, and it's that there's no law anywhere that prohibits you from renting out your car. And so
So it's not that it's against the law, it's that there's a lack of legislation.
Yeah, I mean, there was just no need for a law before that said whether or not you can rent out your car. And so, you know, we provide an insurance policy so that, you know, we keep a member safe because, most personal automobile policies will not cover it if you are renting out your car. So we provide a policy that covers that period. Interestingly, you know, some laws have been passed in three states that have really served to empower car sharing and help us grow. So in California, Oregon, and Washington, laws they've been passed that sort of specifically talk about peer-to-peer car sharing and some of the nuances of insurance regulation. And you know, what we're seeing is that it's really just codifying what would happen anyways. So,
are there markets that you are not in but you don't have that regulation to support you?
So no, Really Rides is launched nationwide. So there's legislation in three states, and we've been operating in Boston for over 2 years and across the country since March. So you know, it's been really encouraging to see the support and sort of the codification of what we believe would happen anyways. But you know, we see that this has really just been empowering the model to continue to grow.
Okay, let's talk about trust and safety. I think the horror stories gain a lot of currency and come to define, in some cases, people's impressions of what you're doing. But you know, they're bound to happen as you expand. Maybe tell us a little bit about how you've dealt with that. And I don't know, let's start with Nate.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we had a high-profile event last summer that kind of put us in the forefront of trust and safety in the sharing economy. And you know, I look back and I see that actually as a major opportunity for us. Coming out of that...
So the backstory was that someone who rented their apartment had it trashed.
Someone's apartment was vandalized. And what we realized was there's actually a lot of tools and protection we can put in place. So coming out of that, we implemented 40 trust and safety features, kind of culminating in a host guarantee that at that time was a $50,000 guarantee, but now has been raised to $1 million. So something that hadn't existed ever before, and frankly, I think reassured a lot of people in the community that what they're doing has some umbrella protection. Mm-hmm. You know, coming out of that, it was very high profile, a little bit painful for us at the time. But now, when it's mentioned, it's always in the context of this is a company that went above and beyond what was expected. It wasn't that they did what was expected. They went and put in place this $1 million guarantee and a bunch of other things. And I think for all of us up here, that's kind of what we need to be thinking about. How can we show consumers that we are out in front of this? That I think nobody really expects you to prevent the impossible, right? Things in life do happen, but what they want to know is that as a company, you are just as involved or have such a stake as the user.
Can I just say one? I think that there's a really big thing that all the companies here share, and I think a lot of the people who have been using these services as well, which is the services are sort of because data is so prevalent, that is, there's a lot of interaction between me and a car sharing service or a co-working space.
And that's documented.
Excuse me?
And that's documented.
Yes, and that it allows the company, the privilege of the company is essentially, or the imperative of the company is to turn that data into real value. And I think that a lot of the data that all these companies have access to is they're pretty diligent, I would say extremely diligent, about using that to create real customer value, that the customers form a community. It's a two-sided marketplace.
Is that true? I mean,
that's
do you
absolutely
have an example
true.
Of that?
I mean, there's certainly been many sites for the last decade where you could rent out your vacation rental or other space. And there was really... it was really a transaction between two people and no kind of overarching basic protection. And what you would get is these classic like Western Union type scams. You wire some money and then there's nothing there. And in a model where payment is facilitated and people are building up reputation and where we can tell you that this account has been on our platform for the last 3 years, those types of abuses don't happen.
I think Nate mentioned something interesting there about reputation, because it's not just about the upfront vetting process that you do at TaskRabbit. We background check 100% of our TaskRabbit base. But it doesn't stop there. Once they're on the site, it is this community, as Lisa said, where they're building up badges and points, and they're getting ratings and reviews for every transaction that goes through the site. And what I think is interesting about that is as we continue to grow this space, the sharing economy space, there's probably an opportunity for us to share reputation and trust across different networks as well.
Would you do that? I mean, it seems like you guys have a lot in common. Are you working together on anything, or would you share users or the reviews that users leave for each other?
I mean, there's definitely been a lot of conversation. I've been in conversations with some of the people on this stage, as well as some of the people in the room who have started companies that are legit. I see JB out there. There are a number of these shared reputation companies that are really sprouting up they realize sort of the social currency that is being developed as you transact on Relay Rides or on Airbnb or TaskRabbit or at the Hub. If you behave well on one of the platforms, it's an indicator of how you'll behave on another platform. And so, a lot of times it can be difficult for somebody that's brand new in a marketplace. So, at Relay Rides, we have just like Airbnb and TaskRabbit, there's a peer-to-peer rating system. As a car owner, we put you in control. You get requests on your vehicle. And then you can take a look at the request, see if the schedule works for you, and then take a look at the person. And so you can look at the person's reputation, see what other car owners have said about them. But the problem becomes, what if you're brand new in the marketplace? If I'm taking a look at your request, it's difficult for me to evaluate you. But if you've been behaving well on Airbnb, you've stayed at a bunch of places, and you've been transacting on TaskRabbit, and you have a good reputation, that can serve as a great proxy. So, I would love to find a way to collaborate within the sharing economy so that we can share that and really I think that it benefits all of us. If your reputation is more valuable and you realize that if you can't just trash a car in Relay Rides, you can't just drop out and go somewhere else. I think that makes the reputation more valuable and people are going to behave even better.
Nate, would you guys be willing to do that at Airbnb, or is your the network of your users is probably one of your most valuable resources.
Yes, but I think we have a mutual interest in making sure that this whole new kind of economic model
So why don't you guys shake hands, make a deal right now?
Yeah, well, are you going on the record, Nate?
I'll point out two problems. Yeah, I know. We have the biggest community, and I would love to share some of our data. But the truth is two problems. One, the logistics of it. Matching data and kind of like there's actually some differences between renting a car and Airbnb. And even if you can overcome that, which you can, two, there's some legal implications. There's liability incurred when I tell you that someone's bad, and what if they're not bad? Or what if I tell you someone is fine and they're not fine? Like, lawyers actually would advise us not to do something like that. Now, not to say that we won't do something like that, but I'm just saying it's not as easy as
sounds
one
like
might think.
You won't do something like that.
I'm not against it.
So I actually had a kind of amazing Airbnb experience 2 days ago. I just want to mention it. So I was booking a beach cottage for a trip actually next week. Was on the phone talking to the guy to get directions, and it turned out through a random process of him asking me where my area code was from that. His son is a classmate of my husband in grad school, and they know each other really well. And it turned into like kind of a really great serendipitous, cool connection. And it led me to think about how much your sites are about communities of people and how much your sites are about offering an efficient access to a service or a resource when someone wants it. Because sometimes I just want my TaskRabbit to deliver my IKEA furniture now, and I don't really care who they are, perhaps. But sometimes it's really nice that I'm staying at a cottage that might have family pictures of someone I know in it.
Well, what you said right there that's really interesting is it probably made you more comfortable staying at that cottage knowing that you had that connection. And so the way we think about it at TaskRabbit is, can we use the social graph to show that you're a couple of degrees of separation away from the TaskRabbit you're working with. Or if your friend on Facebook used the same TaskRabbit and rated him 5-star reviews, ratings and reviews, then you're going to be more comfortable using that TaskRabbit as well. So the way I see it, the big thing there is that the social graph allows us to build trust in the community. And it is about a community, and it's about getting people to feel more comfortable meeting offline.
And the trust isn't necessarily just between you and the person on the other side. We can also just show you how you're generally connected to other people using the Airbnb service. And that makes people just more comfortable that people they know are also using the product, and they can see the types of experiences they had. And, okay, now they're willing to go out and stay with somebody. Now, you know, I think the world is a smaller place than we realize. And the features like social connections, using the social graph to show how you're connected, or just having these rich profiles that really give you a sense of who that other person is allowing people to I think, really relate and have the special experiences that have made Airbnb so sticky.
Yeah, I think that the social connections in the community are really one of the reasons why people love using RelayRides. It's they love the fact that their money is going into one of their neighbors' pockets. It's staying right in their local community, and it's connecting them to their neighbors in a way that's sort of been lost. You know, the days of borrowing sugar from your neighbor are sort of long gone. And, you know, TaskRabbit and RelayRides are really community-based services where you're dealing with people right in your community.
And but you must have some users who just use RelayRides, perhaps in San Francisco or a place where you have a lot of density, just because there's more cars more close to where they live.
You know, I mean, I think the way that we get people's attention and the reason why they first sign up is a rational reason. I need to get from point A to point B. I have a car that sits around most of the time. I need to pay some bills. You know, whatever it is, there's a very rational trigger that sort of draws you in. But I think the reason why people come back is a lot of these sort of more emotional reasons. The fact that they're giving back to their community, that they're connecting with their neighbors in a way they haven't recently, or they're making it more easier to live in their community without a car. So
Corey, there's a lot of shared office spaces in the world, but what yours is more of a community, right? Like, what is the distinction between those things? How do you make that happen?
Well, yeah, it really is a community. I think one of the main things with the Hub Bay Area, but the Hub network in general around the world, is everyone has a shared purpose of being part of the Hub, that they're working on something that's positive for people of the planet. And that framework is really important in a lot of ways. Our tagline is where change goes to work. And so that's an important area that people can start to collaborate, but we also look at the space and try to have a series of events, the way we lay out the space, where we have serendipity zones and other places where people can connect, collide, and try to create the environments for innovation to happen and collaboration to happen and spur that forth. And we also have hosts in all the spaces. So the hosts play a vital role of connecting people and understanding what one person's doing and connect them to others. And now that we have 25 hubs around the world and growing rapidly, in North America alone, we're looking at, with the Hub Cities program that we're a part of, we're looking at helping to catalyze the openings of hubs in this year in Seattle, Boulder, D.C., Charlotte, Boston as well. And so now we're talking about connecting all the other communities as well. So we have a meta-network of communities, and we're using tools in order to allow that to happen.
This show better air on the radio in Boston. I think this is the highest Boston shout-out quotient ever. Okay, so in San Francisco, I would say it's fair to say that we've had a pretty poor history of transit options. But because of the wealth of technology startups here, I feel like that's changing a bit. So I think Lisa had mentioned earlier Sidecar, which is not even a car sharing service, it's a ride sharing service. So instead of calling a taxi, I can just call some dude and he'll come pick me up with my app. And there's another one called Lyft. And I think they're pretty much direct competitors, and the only market in the world that they're in is San Francisco. So that's great. It's super useful for me. It's cheap, and it's actually kind of fun to talk to random people who answered Craigslist ads to drive their cars around. When are you guys expanding to other places, and where are you expanded to? Do the services you offer work better in cities? Are they going international? Do you need a partner to do that? Tell us a little bit about that.
Airbnb is probably the most international at this point. We have properties in over 192 countries, over 25,000 different cities. We now have 10 offices that we've opened. We have more properties abroad than we do in the U.S. by far. 110,000 in Europe, 55,000 in the U.S., about over 200,000 total. And more of the revenue is coming from abroad as well. So clearly a powerful, I think, testimony to the concept being able to thrive so much in all these different markets, all these different cultures. Now, right now, we certainly have the most density in cities. Those are kind of international destinations. But we're seeing it branch out. We're seeing, we see this incredible long tail. We have, again, properties in 25,000 cities. So, yeah, we have 10,000 in London, but we also have 50 in places you've never heard of.
Yeah. So we launched in Boston, and then San Francisco is our second city. But then in March, we launched nationwide. And that was a really exciting day for us because, you know, we feel that there are really strong benefits to car sharing. It takes cars off the road. It reduces driving. It reduces transportation costs. But our estimate is that before Relay Rides, only about 15 million Americans had access to car sharing, so they could walk to a car in under 10 minutes.
This is something like Zipcar?
Yeah. So the reason is because traditional car sharing services, they have a lot of overhead, very high fixed costs. It's very expensive to own and maintain a fleet of vehicles. And so they can only operate in sort of a handful of dense urban areas that are really well served by public transit. But so with our model, a peer-to-peer model, we completely turn that on its head. A car owner is already paying the majority of those fixed costs, and so we can operate anywhere. So we launched nationwide, and we've got cars in 47 states. We've got all the way from Anchorage, Alaska, down to the tip of Florida. And for the first time, we feel that we're democratizing the benefits of car sharing, so that no matter where you live, you can have car sharing in your neighborhood in under 5 minutes. It's been really exciting to see things take off in, you know, New York and L.A. And maybe some smaller cities. But what I'm really excited to see is, for the first time, these benefits of alternative mobility reaching the suburbs or less dense areas. And, you know, I think the service looks a little bit different. And so we're still learning a lot about what this looks like. But
have you launched in any suburbs?
We definitely have cars, all up and down the peninsula. We've got cars in any urban area that we have cars in. We also have cars sort of in the cars in the outlying areas, thousands of cars across the country. And it's interesting because people are using the cars differently in those other areas. So we talk a lot about 1.5 or 2.5 car households. So these households that they always need one car and sometimes need two. And previously what happened, people would round up. They had to if they needed that second car. There was no other way, a convenient way to access that transportation. And so, you know, what we believe that we're empowering is people to round down, to not buy that second car and access that car in their neighborhood. We're still learning a lot, and it's growing really fast, and it's exciting to see for the first time car sharing reach outside of the urban areas.
What about you, Leah?
Yeah, with TaskRabbit, so we're open right now in 9 major cities across the country: Boston, New York, Los Angeles, Seattle, San Francisco, Austin, all the major ones. But on a daily basis, we get emails from people all over the country, even all over the world, asking when TaskRabbit's going to open in their community. And we've sort of started this voting page where people can vote up their markets. But sort of a funny story. Early on, when I was back in Boston, with just that one city open, there was this man named Roberto in Rome, Italy, that somehow found my cell phone and would call me on a daily basis and leave these messages in Italian about how he wanted TaskRabbit to come there and that he would help launch it. And to me,
I hope he's your community manager now.
To me, it was really interesting because, you know, a year in one city in the U.S., I had this person internationally. I mean, this is an idea that resonates with people globally, and that was really exciting to see. And
so where are you going next?
We're moving as fast as we can. I think we'll do international, early next year.
Okay. What about the hub?
Well, the hub is actually started in London, and so it's been international.
When did it start in London?
It started almost 8 years ago in London, I believe it is, and then grew Europe first, and then was brought here in a few years ago. And so we already have a large network, and it's really inspiring to see all these hubs opening up around the world. When we start to see a real network connection of hubs, of all these people that are coming together to work on solutions to make the world a better place in some way, it's really heartening to see that that's happening all around the globe. And so when you can imagine all of these hubs opening up and expanding and doubling, the power of those networks and those small businesses as they become connected for good in their local communities, and as those start to get connected, what the power of the overall network can be. So we're really, what we're creating is a platform for people, capital, and ideas. But it's a global network at the end of the day, and it's exciting to see.
I was just going to say, as a customer of a lot of these things as well, one of the things I've discovered as being really different than, let's say, an old model of franchising, is that when I go to the hub in Sao Paulo or the hub in London or Barcelona, it's full of people from those cities. I have the ability to go native really fast. And it allows me as an entrepreneur, if I'm trying to tap into those cities, like it's a great place for anybody on this panel to go hang out in a hub because you'll meet the local entrepreneurs really rapidly. When I used an Airbnb property in Paris as well, the experience of Airbnb in France is not the experience that you have here. And it's really nicely infused by the local culture and community.
So we're going to take audience questions in about 5 minutes if you want to go up to one of the two mics. So excuse this assumption, but in a way it seems like you guys live on this alternative collaborative consumption planet, and a whole bunch of other people live in the regular economy, the not shared economy. And I wonder how you're seeing those things come together, if when you explain what your service does, people look at you like, huh, and you have to do it again, or if they're starting to kind of connect your ideas with things that they feel more are close to their own.
So we feel like we're really starting to bridge that gap from the island of San Francisco into the mainstream. And one of the, I think one great sign of this is a partnership we just launched with General Motors. So we did a really cool technology integration with them with their safety and security platform OnStar. So any car owner can sign up their car and Relay Rides have a profile in under 5 minutes. If your car is one of the 15 million that on the road that already has OnStar in the car, you have the option of linking your OnStar and the Relay Rides accounts. And then when a renter has the car reserved, they can walk up and they can text message the car or use an app to unlock it, so the car owner doesn't have to meet.
And that's live?
It's live. It launched about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So it's really exciting. I mean, I think it's this great experience for owners. It's the easiest and safest that car sharing has ever been. But working with a company like General Motors is really exciting. I mean, this works in 15 million cars. To put that in perspective, Zipcar, the world's largest car sharing service, has 9,000 cars. It's a huge opportunity for growth for us, and it's also.
Did they call you, or did you call them?
A little bit of both. I think we called them. It's sort of serendipitous in terms of, they were thinking about ways that they can do more than just sell cars in terms of selling mobility. This is a lot of what people are asking for these days, and we also sort of helped them understand that that car sharing is a way to expose people to your cars. So. An extended test drive, if you will. So maybe you don't want to buy a car right now, but maybe down the road you're gonna move or you're gonna have a family and you do need to buy a car. If you've been driving a Chevy Volt for the past 5 years, you're much more likely to buy that car. So it's been very exciting to work with such a big brand. That I think is helping to pull us to the mainstream and can definitely continue to help us grow.
I see that as removing friction. I also do think, though, we are asking people to do something they haven't done before, and that's a new behavior. And people, not everyone is going to sign up at the same time. People are going to want to hear that someone else they know did it, yep. Or two people, or three people. We've seen this. in the last 5 months, we did 5 million guest nights booked. What's crazy is to do the first 5 million took 3.5 years.
Wow.
Right. So
guys just said your biggest night ever was like a couple weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
Like
the acceleration has been incredible. Yeah. So last week actually, we announced that we had done 60,000 guests in one night staying on Airbnb accommodations. But we've been at it for 4 years. And if you look back just 1 year ago, the number is a fraction of that. So I think we're talking about it now, and it's somewhat impressive, certainly for Airbnb and all these other services. But I think none of us have any idea what it looks like 1 year from now. because there are so many people who are waiting to hear that their friend has done it, or they're waiting for their second friend to do it. And once that happens, you're just going to see more and more people pile on faster and faster. Or at least that's what we've seen so far.
There are more cars in the United States than drivers, significantly more. So the opportunity is huge.
I was just going to say that we're not selling into a trend that doesn't already exist. In other words, a lot of these things, people have more properties than they're using, or more cars that they're using, or more talent. And so a lot of these services are actually just really well-timed and honed to something that really speaks to people. And I think that, you know, part of the success isn't that we're trying to sell snow to the Eskimos, you know. It's well, that might be useful in the future years, but
snow is kind of hard to share.
In the case of the Hub Bay area, it's an easy value proposition. If you're an entrepreneur and you're a startup and you're getting ready to start up, you have a certain amount of dollars to spend, and you can go sign that lease for the office, then go install your Wi-Fi and get your chairs and do all those sort of things, and that's awfully convenient to have everything. But you do go through that entire process, and then you're isolated in your office. So the value proposition is spreading very quickly for people that want to start up something quick, and they want to just get a number of hours to get going. They can start at as low as 10 hours a month, and then go all the way to full time or have a permanent office.
So as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. And tonight we're hosting the Shared Economy, Doing Business with the Joneses. And we're here with Lisa Gansky, author of The Mesh, Why the Future of the Business is Sharing, Shelby Clark, the founder and CCO of Relay Rides, Leah Buskey, the founder and CEO of TaskRabbit, Corey Smith, the CEO of Hub Bay Area and SoCap, and Nate Blacharczyk, the CTO and co-founder of Airbnb. I'm Liz Gaines. I'm the senior editor at All Things Digital, and now we're going to hear from our audience. So let's hope for just one question from each of you and try to direct it towards one of our panelists, if you would. Go ahead.
So you can rent an office, you can rent your bike, you can rent your home, you can even sell the possibility of giving birth or carrying a child. What is the future of the sharing economy? What are the limits of sharing?
Big question. How about a small answer?
There are no limits. I mean, I think we're the limit, you know, that it's a function of what we're willing to expand, and we see that increasingly every day. I mean, I started with a site that had 1,200 instances because I was trying to convince myself it was happening. And less than 2 years later, it's at about 7,500. So these things are happening all over the world: food, fashion, finance, travel, transportation, work. And I think it's amazing every day. We're astonished at what people are starting. And so if you have an idea, now's a good time.
You know, I think that one of the areas to watch are where people spend a lot of money. And if there's sharing can introduce efficiencies and just make things, you know, a little smarter. So where do people spend their money? You know, food, healthcare, childcare. You know, these are things, what?
Transportation.
Well, of course, transportation. Education. So, you know, I think these are the areas that we're next going to see disruption through sharing.
Next question.
Any plan to establish a sustainable charitable component, such as choose me as a rabbit and I'll donate 10% of my proceeds to AIDS Walk, or rent my car and I'll plant a tree, or host me and I'll, or choose me as a host and I'll host someone who's displaced by a natural disaster?
Sounds like a good challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love that idea. We've chatted about it at TaskRabbit for many years now, and I think in the future you'll start to see more ways that we can connect not only transaction-based online, but with the communities as well, and drive more value in our own neighborhoods.
Next question.
I guess for Nate or anybody else up there. Jenny Lasker, I'm starting a mobile startup, and I bet there are a bunch of people listening to this program who have the same kind of idea of starting a startup, right? So what learnings have you learned over the years since you started out that you can share with us? You know, what do you start with? Do you start with a business plan that you're going to throw out the window anyway? Or do you start coding right away? Or, you know, do you start hiring people? Or, you know, how do you get this stuff off the ground?
You start by hopefully solving your own problem or a problem you're very familiar with. You know, for us, it was a difficult journey. There was a year before we had a solid direction and traction. So I'd also say, you know, just be prepared to go on a long journey. Pace yourself. Most common thing I see is people burning out, thinking that in 2 months, 3 months, they're going to figure it out. They're going to raise money, and like you know, life will be good. But it's hard. It takes a while and a little bit of luck. So if I had to say one thing, that would be it.
Next question.
Hi. Thank you very much. I'm trained as a lawyer and got in early to microfinance and spent a lot of time dealing with the legal and policy issues around investing in the developing world and the role of social capital, now seeing a lot of similar trends in the sharing economy. And this is a question for Nate. Given how much of your traffic now is developed internationally and the challenge, some of the challenges you faced, say, in the legal and policy space here in San Francisco and in New York, my question is, have you encountered similar challenges or pushback from governments abroad, the government of Paris or Sydney or whatever? And if so, how have you dealt with it? And if not, why not?
Sure. Well, I think the concerns are all very similar. They're all very reasonable. There's just a whole bunch of stakeholders. Turns out that you know everyone's interested in having a dialogue. Many do see the opportunity, but they want to make sure that their concerns are addressed. And right now, there's a lot of conversations in progress, including in San Francisco. And props to San Francisco for creating a sharing economy working group. But there's a number of productive conversations happening. But it will take time. Like, there's this whole legacy infrastructure of legal complexity that has to be addressed in stakeholders. If someone's expecting a quick answer, there's not going to be one.
Next question.
Thanks very much for being here. Question is, to what extent can users of your services, or do you envision users of your services, to be able to pay or get paid, not in cash, but in other services, like a task for a task, a place for a place, a car for a car?
We haven't built this yet, but I'm really intrigued by it. You know, I think that people tend to buy a car that's sort of one size fits all. So you see a lot of people driving about, you know, around a big SUV by themselves. And, you know, I would love to see a world where that doesn't happen, where if you are one person going, you know, you'd be driving a much more fuel-efficient vehicle. And that one time a month when you carry around six kids and a dog, you can borrow that large car from your neighbor as opposed to needing to own that car and driving it all the time. So we haven't got there quite yet, but I think it is really interesting to think about this sort of idea of being able to swap a car and ways that make a lot of that make more sense economically and for the environment.
I would just make a quick comment that I've seen one network do it that's called Loose Cubes. That's actually a network of co-working spaces, and they're doing it in a way where if I have 10 available desks, I can decide I really want people who speak Russian or are UX designers, and if somebody appears like that, they can have it for free. So we'll trade a little bit of service in exchange for the spot. The other group that's a secret, so don't tell anyone yet, is a company called Yertle that's basically moving to look at how the sensation of something that's new to you is almost as good as something, or it may be even better than something that's actually new. And so it's really looking at sharing as the new shopping, which creates this kind of swapping that you were referring to as well.
Next question.
I really appreciate the comment, I think it was from Nate, that part of the value for the consumers is also the experience of the services that you offer, you know, which I think is really key to achieving the next level of adoption. But so how, you know, in other ways besides the kind of economic and resource argument, how do you get consumers to choose to share instead of own?
How do you get consumers to share rather than own it?
I mean, ultimately, you know, if a consumer, you know, I think you were talking about with relay rides to, you know, the 1.5 car households.
What are some of the motivations?
Beyond the kind of economic and resource arguments. What other narratives do you try to tell in order to convince the consumer that's the best choice?
For us, you know, people understand the economic argument. Like, you can do the math. The other arguments people come to realize, but it's hard to sell them on that alone, unless they have some previous experience with it. Maybe they've traveled the world for us and love meeting new people. But I will say that people say, you know, I started doing this for the money. I keep doing it because it's so much fun. And they really stress all the interesting people they've met from around the world. Some people say it's a way of traveling without ever leaving my home. So people definitely get it, but typically not through like a conversation at the onset.
Next question.
Yeah, I wanted to back up to your implementation steps. Before people had heard of Airbnb, TaskRabbit, we have a lot of skeptics out there, people that have never dealt with any of this before. What are you doing to get over that hump, I guess, and get your name out there, make people feel comfortable with what they're doing?
Yeah, maybe for us it's sort of a numbers game. You know, I think there are 260, I mentioned this earlier, there's 260 million cars on the road, or in the United States, which is 1.2 cars for every licensed driver. And Zipcar, the world's largest car sharing service, has 9,000 cars. So I think that it's been a while since I've done the math. I think that's 0.003% of cars out there. This resonates with people. It really does. I mean, there are people who get enormous value from giving back to their community and who can really use the extra money to pay off their car payment or their insurance. And so, you know, even if it resonates with sort of a small fraction of people, that can be really significant, and it really snowballs over time. So, you know, growth has really picked up for us. We've increased our number of cars about 10x in the past 5 months. So, it's been very exciting to see the growth. And you start with a small number of people. It spreads virally through as Nate mentioned, sort of hearing good experiences from.
The bottom line is it takes time though. There's no silver bullet here. It's not like you're going to go from zero to 100,000 in 5 months. It takes positive.
Sorry. Yeah. Please. No, carry on.
I was just going to say, it takes positive testimony, right? People telling other people. And in our case, at least, and I'm sure in everyone's case, people are having such positive experiences that they're telling more than one person, right? So one person does it, five people learn about it, and it goes from there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like you want to become the metaphor, right? So Relay Rides at first was Zipcar for regular people's cars. Now there's like a bike sharing service that's Relay Rides for bikes, right?
Right.
So you want to get to that point. Next question.
Hi. Hello.
Shin Chung, Trust Cloud, Trust System for the Sharing Economy. Question for Leah, Shelby, and Nate. So I have a credit score. I think I own that data, meaning I contributed through my loans, my banks, my bank account, and credit cards. I also use Airbnb. I use TaskRabbit. I use Relay Rides. So the question is that do the companies or do the people own that data?
I think it's an interesting question. I think I'm seeing a lot of different platforms pop up and attack that problem in different ways. Jeremy from Legit, we've chatted a lot about his platform. And I think that it's going to be up to the consumers to have to want to opt in and participate across a lot of different networks. And I think that's going to be the key there.
Next question.
Hi. I was at the Hub yesterday, and there was a lady. She actually had a very interesting critique towards the shared economy which is growing up. And I understood it like this. Like, it's kind of a privileged market. Like, are you trying to... It serves the people. They solve their own problems, you know? And they solve their problems which not everybody has in the society. So my question is there any, like... objective to go that maybe people, richer people would share their helicopters, poor people would share their problems, you know what I mean, like to go up or down.
Sure. I mean, I think that, you know, that you can look at models where there's currently whatever it's called, X-Jets or in these various Magellan jets. That's essentially, you know, a fancy share service, right? I mean, it's not a bike, but it's a jet. And so there is sort of these models that allow you to essentially do effectively a timeshare or to amortize or to, not really amortize, but to allow more people to gain access to something that you or someone owns. And that could come at any point in the market. You know, people can do it with castles. They can have Rolls Royces. You know, they can have some rock star CEO that's running some really complicated task.
It's a matter of where you come in, and I think the models, all of the companies and the businesses will meet you where you are. I mean, the business model and the share economy is very flexible.
So we're almost out of time, and I'm going to pull the moderator's privilege right now because that's my mother-in-law waiting to ask a question. So no. So I'm saying you should go. I won't hear the end of it for dinner if I don't allow you to ask your question.
I was going to ask the Airbnb guy. Neil? No, Nate.
Nate. Yes.
Okay. Even if everybody tells me it's a good idea, I'm concerned about trading my house while I'm not there because of my privacy concerns. Is that something that you address before I even provide my house? I mean, do you give literature that says this is why you don't have to be concerned about privacy? Or do you ask me a lot of private information that you then have access to pass on to other people?
Sure. Well, you absolutely choose what you want to share with us. I mean, actually, the bare minimum is fairly basic, right? However, the more you provide, the more trustworthy you're going to be to people who might want to stay there. Now, we're not going to share certain things like your phone number, your address, or your last name to just anybody. That you're going to control. So if someone's interested, they'll request to stay with you. If you choose to accept them after doing your kind of evaluation of, hey, who are you? Why are you coming here? If you do accept them, at that point, then information like phone number, address, your last name, that will be shared then. So no one is going to get that kind of personal information without you explicitly clicking the accept button. So I think it's really important to allow people to control their privacy and what people know about them, absolutely.
Okay, so let's see. It is time for our last question, and it is the inform tradition to ask all of our speakers the following. Lisa, Shelby, Leah, Corey, and Nate, what is your quick idea to change the world? Shelby.
So I think a lot about the future of transit. And, you know, in 1985, Marty McFly promises hoverboards. And so, you know, thinking about, is this the future of transit? And I really think it's unfortunately not hoverboards, but I think it's providing the right transportation to people at the right times. So, you know, the right size car whenever, depending on the errand that you're going on, or maybe it's access to a bicycle or a ride in some guy's car from Craigslist. But, you know, I think that providing the right transportation to people in convenient ways at the right times can lead to huge efficiencies for the environment and the economy.
Nate.
I think we can make the world a smaller place. The idea that you can go onto a website and within an hour basically have set up an experience where you're going to have your own apartment in Paris that is owned by a Parisian and feels as such, and they're going to give you recommendations on where to eat, where to go out for a drink, and other recommendations. And you're going to be in a neighborhood that is not Union Square, but, say, the Mission or somewhere else. It's truly powerful. And hopefully people will develop a better connection with each other and with their local communities.
Lisa.
Yeah, I was going to say going native is always my first, which is the ability to dive deep into other cultures. And I think that you can do it, you know, food, using all share economy services, food, things like Airbnb, certainly the hub as well. The other quick thing I was going to mention besides going native is just, like, for example, in Spain right now, there's 50% youth unemployment, and in the United States, and there's plenty of youth unemployment in the U.S. as well. In the United States, the last week I heard the stat from the AARP team that 15,000 people a day turn 55, and that trend will continue for the next 15 years in the U.S. So the U.S. and Western Europe is just going to have like a lot of people who are 55 and older, and then there's a bunch of unemployed youth. I'm really keen on things like tech shop and the hub and culinary kitchens, tools libraries, because there's a lot of people and equipment that is just sitting around, and real ability to have this intermingling, whether it's between languages and cultures or just here in our own hometown. I just have seen such power in bringing people together in that way, and it's really powerful and also quite entertaining. So I'm really keen on that.
Corey?
Well, I have lots of personal ideas for changing the world, but really the thing that excites me the most is the fact that we've got all these entrepreneurs working together for their own ideas to help change the world, and then that's replicated throughout through other hubs around the world. So what I see as a way is just organizing the experience better so people can take ideas, move them into prototypes, get them into beta stage and into the market as quickly as possible so that more ideas can be catalyzed more quickly.
Leah?
I've got an idea that can change the world tomorrow if we all participate. Pay it forward. Share a special skill, service, a talent with someone around you. Help someone out. And if everyone in the world did that tomorrow, it would be a completely different place.
I feel like asking you guys a question about how you want to change the world is a little bit easier than maybe some speakers.
How are you going to change the world? Yeah, how are
you? I'm going to keep writing about you guys and exposing you to an audience and asking you hard questions, too.
Cleverly picking your mother-in-law as well.
Nepotism, that's the secret. So thank you to Lisa, Shelby, Leah, Corey, and Nate for sharing your ideas and innovations. This meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.